This is a HeadGum Podcast.
While Andrew and Craig believe the joy of discovery is crucial to enjoying any well-told tale, they will not shy away from spoiling specific story beats when necessary. Plus, these are books you should have read by now.
Welcome to Overdue. It's a podcast about the books you've been meaning to read. My name is Craig.
My name is Andrew. I appreciate that, because I'm a little loopy right now, so I appreciate that we did like the clap that we do to sync up our audio track, and then you just went right into it.
Yeah, why wait?
You didn't give me a chance to like fall off the fence again into not being ready to podcast.
Yeah, I got to keep, I'm here. We're locked in. Mm-hmm. I'm not over there. I'm over here.
You're over here.
I'm not over there. Mm-hmm. I'm over here.
Oh, that's funny.
I'm ready to talk about books on this year podcast with you, my friend Andrew. Each week, one of us reads a book and tells the other person about it so that you, the listener, can learn about a book or learn about our opinions about a book you've read.
Or both.
Why are you here? Tell us sometime. But Andrew... Why are you here? What book did you read this week?
I read this week the book They're There by Tommy Orange.
Oh, They're There by Tommy Orange.
Yeah.
I'm excited to hear about it. I've heard about this book, and it sounds kind of neat. We did.
And there's a sequel coming out.
Yes. It came out, I think. Year.
Oh, it came out?
February?
It came out in February?
Wandering Stars.
Nice.
Yeah, I think it came out. It was available to order from one of the publisher websites.
Well, just because it's ready to order, that might be a pre-order, my dude.
Well,
but let me see.
You're going to check it.
Wikipedia did not refer to it in the present tense.
Yeah,
but it does appear to be available. Yeah. Wandering Stars, a novel.
Just in
case you were wondering
now.
Whether if it was a novel or not.
They always say that. I know they always do. But this is a novel also. I'm led to believe.
Here's the funny thing about that is that it starts with a few essays.
Oh.
And so I read through a few of the essays and I was like, this is a novel though, right? And so I did look at the cover to see if it said there a novel on it, and this time it didn't. And so the one time I looked the one time I tried to check to make sure it wasn't there for me. And so I guess I can't make fun of it anymore.
That's very funny. A few years ago we did a feed drop with the show Storybound and had a short story from Tommy Orange on. And so he's been on my radar since then. And I'm glad that we're able to finally talk about him. He's an author.
Friend of the show, Tommy Orange.
Yeah, yeah, he doesn't know that. I'm not sure. I don't know. Who knows? But this is his debut novel, published in 2018. He is an author, he's a member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes. Native author, born in 1982. He got his MFA from the Institute of American Indian Arts in New Mexico. I couldn't find what community college he studied at, but in multiple interviews he said, yeah, I studied sound at a community college.
Cool. Like, I don't know what that... I mean, like I guess he probably means like audio equipment or like art or...
Kind of like, I think like a little bit of music... Audio engineering and like audio installation art kind of stuff.
Because if you just say that you studied sound, it does kind of sound like, yeah, I just sat around and listened to stuff.
Remember when we were going to college?
And that yes.
Our college used to, you know, really likes to talk about how you can make your own major sometimes. And there was that story of that one guy who his major was coffee.
Uh-huh. I wonder about that guy.
Is that guy real?
If he's real and what...
does he listen?
And what like data entry or like PR job he ended up getting with his coffee degree.
Yes. Well, you got to bring the liberal arts to every industry, Andrew.
Yeah, that's true. Even coffee.
Tommy Orange was born and raised in Oakland, California. He's a 2014 McDowell Fellow, 2016 Writing by Writers Fellow. He also teaches... at the Institute of American Indian Arts. This book won a lot of awards. A whole bunch of them. The American Book Award, the John Lennard Prize from the National Books Critics Circle, the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize, the Anisfeld Wolf Book Award for Fiction. It was shortlisted for the Carnegie Medal as a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. It was number one on the San Francisco Chronicle bestseller list, and it was a top 10 book in the New York Times bestseller list. Everybody was pumped about this book, and every review was like, yo, that title, gotta tell you about it.
Yeah.
Does the book tell you what the title's about?
Is it all exclusively about the
Gertrude Stein quote?
Yeah, Gertrude Stein quote. I have a little bit. There's a bit in the book where he talks, or a character talks about it that
great.
We can.
All right, we'll talk about that a little bit.
But
later.
Yeah. It's a Gertrude Stein quote, but also Radiohead.
Yes, it's a little bit of
but also a Radiohead song. Yeah.
The most comprehensive profile I found of Orange was in the New York Times by Alexander Alter. It is called Tommy Orange Is There Is a New Kind of American Epic. Talks about him growing up in the Oakland area. His father was a Native American church leader. He had a white mom who was a hippie who then converted to evangelical Christianity. Caused some tension in their households until she left that sect of her life. And the story goes on to put him into context with other contemporary Native authors who are like challenging stereotypes, they're challenging form, they're challenging established expectations of what Native authors write about. I think the big thing that I saw about this book and what Orange is talking about is that he lived in an urban, you know, culture growing up. Like, I think he talks in an interview with BookWeb, I think, or maybe that was the Entertainment Weekly article I read that was about, like, yeah, in the 50s and 60s, a bunch of Native folks like moved into cities, and like that is just not a part of what a lot of pop culture depictions of Native folks are.
There are a lot of ruminations about that in this book, and about how stereotypically it's all about, you know, getting back to the land, I think even if you're talking about how Indigenous people are depicted in popular culture, I think you see a lot of stuff that's like on a reservation or like out in the like.
More
dances
rural,
with
yeah,
wolves,
yeah.
Like,
oh God, yeah, you're in that territory, yeah.
He's talking about how, you know, the land is everywhere, and there are like cities up on some of it, and it's, you know, that's part of the experience now too.
This book, he says, the idea came to him in 2010. He did not, you know, as I said, he did not go to school for writing. He was doing odd jobs, worked at a used bookstore, and kind of fell in love with reading and writing in his 20s, and then had an idea for this book in 2010. He had been doing he'd gotten a grant to do like a StoryCorps community narrative project, and was on a powwow committee and had this idea to like bring together urban natives to talk about their experience. And in one interview, he offhandedly makes it sound like he never actually finished that grant project and then turned it into this novel instead, which, you know.
That would also be kind of vaguely reflected in something that a couple of characters in this book do.
Sure. Okay, great. Okay. So he kind of had that idea, and then it took him, you know, 6 years to really get rolling on it. The American Indian Art Institute's, like, graduate writing program wasn't spun up until 2013, so that's when he gets into there after that, and it's been this incubator for all sorts of new Native voices. And then this book comes out and it's like a sensation. Everybody's very excited about it. The reviews are pretty glowing. I think I found maybe one or two that have at most like a knock against it, or kind of can point out, if it doesn't work for you, here's maybe why. But nobody is, everybody, people, pronoun, what am I saying? People like this book and they're generally excited about it.
The critical consensus about this book is that it's good, I think is what you're trying to say.
That's what I'm trying to say.
You don't have to like account for everything that every individual person is.
I just got wrapped up in which way I wanted to construct a sentence.
I am curious to hear like the critical things that you did hear. I'm curious to talk about them because I don't know if I did like this book. There was a moment in the middle where it became clear that it was going to end in like a mass shooting. And I was like, well, that sucks.
Oh boy. Yeah. Well, good to know. Okay.
But yeah. It is a very interesting book. It has a lot of interesting perspectives in it.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah. That's where I come down. Add me to the critical consensus, please.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break and then you can join the nobody, somebody, everybody list of critics.
Okay. Craig, this week's podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Have you ever scrolled through a website and you're just reading it and you think to yourself, there's no there there?
I have. I have looked at websites and found them wanting.
Yeah.
Because there simply was nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
There.
Well, if you find yourself wanting a better website, you should use Squarespace. It's a website that helps you make websites by giving you beautiful templates, easy-to-use drag-and-drop tools, 24/7 customer support, and so much more. All the things you need to make a great website without really needing to know how to make a great website.
I don't want to know how to do it except how to do it with Squarespace. So please tell me.
Yeah, here's how you make a website without learning how to make a website with Squarespace. Splish splash, I was taking a bath in the Fluid Engine, a next generation website design system from Squarespace. It's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity. Start with a best-in-class website template and customize every design detail with reimagined drag and drop technology for desktop or mobile. They also give you flexible website templates. Get started with one of their professional website templates with designs for every category and use case. Then customize your look, update content, and add features to fit your unique needs. You can make any Squarespace template do what you want so your idea, brand, or business stands out online on every device, baby. Casio watches, tablets, graphing calculators, every device.
The little probably. Memory card thing from the Dreamcast.
From the Dreamcast, yeah, right. They've also got blogging tools that you can use to share stories, photos, videos, and updates, categorize, share, and schedule your posts to make your content work for you. Craig, this sounds good to you. This is there. Squarespace.com. There is where you go for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/overdue to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Again, that's squarespace.com/overdue to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Where do you want to start, Andrew?
It's a great question.
There's a prologue in this book that a lot of people in the critical community, the critics community.
You're talking about the critics community again.
Yeah.
My community that I'm in.
That it came up a lot. The two things that came up in almost every review I read were the title, which I'm sure we'll talk about, and whatever this opening is. Mm-hmm. So how does the book open?
As I mentioned before when I was talking about the novel thing, the prologue does have some things that feel more essay-ish than fictional. I mean, they do have a voice to them that makes them not strictly like, here's an educational essay about Native history and what you need to know to understand this book. But it does, but before introducing any characters, anything, it just sets up kind of what some of the themes are going to be in a few just like short paragraphs.
Okay.
Under a few different subheadings. One of them is about, you know, white people taking land from the people who lived here before we got here.
Sure.
So, you know, that thing.
Is it like talking about individual people? Is it kind of a zoomed out encyclopedia voice?
It's
you don't have to dwell on it. I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, it begins with an essay called Indian Head. There was an Indian head, the head of an Indian, the drawing of the head of a headdressed, long-haired Indian depicted, drawn by an unknown artist in 1939, broadcast until the late 1970s to American TVs everywhere after all the shows ran out. It's called the Indian Head Test Pattern. If you left the TV on, you'd hear a tone at 440 hertz, the tone used to tune instruments, and you'd see that Indian surrounded by circles that looked like sights through rifle scopes. There was what looked like a bullseye in the middle of the screen. With numbers like coordinates, the Indian's head was just above the bullseye. Like, all you need to do was nod up in agreement to set the sights on the target. This was just a test. And then from there, it says, in 1621, colonists invited the chief of the Wampanoags to a feast after a recent land deal. 200 Indians dropped dead that night from an unknown poison, and a couple other anecdotes like that.
Okay. Okay. So kind of a, like, a modern-ish, here is like a depiction that is itself strange, if not problematic, whatever you want to think about it, and then let's get into the violent history going as far back as we can. So, like, kind of spanning the, you know, centuries of what has gone on here.
I mean, a little bit. It's mostly just talking about initial interactions between white people and Native people, and saying, hey, the white people were not on the level in dealing with these people. And, like, sure. this is what we are dealing with, and having been, like, forcibly assimilated into this culture, and what we're kind of having to fight back against as we try to find what our identity is, because there's a lot of searching for identity in this book. There's a lot of thinking about identity, but there's also a lot of, like, what does it mean to be Native? Am I even Native? Do I present that way? Do I feel that way?
Yep.
Like, do I feel like I'm faking? If I'm in a big group of people and we're all together doing something, does it feel like we're all just dressing up and playing pretend? Like, there's a lot of ruminating on that, and not a lot of, like, declarative statements about,
sure,
who is right and who isn't, because I think the point is that the experience, especially, like, the modern Native experience, encompasses all of these things,
and
having those thoughts is part of being part of that, like, culture and community,
and having those thoughts, you cannot escape the fact in this position that you are having those thoughts in a world where this history happened. Right, like, that seems to be the point of including this. He told, I think it was the New York Times, he said, as Native writers, there's a certain feeling that you have to set the record straight before you even begin. It's been told wrong and not told so often. And then in an Entertainment Weekly interview with David Canfield, he said, I love prologues. I love that they can contextualize. I love that they're optional. You could just skip them if you wanted. But he says, I think as Native people, we have a history of learning bad history and not only not hearing our stories, but hearing it told wrong. It's covered up, or it's a downright lie about what went down in American history. To a large extent, the collective American consciousness still buys into somewhat of a heroic past. So he wants to express it from a Native perspective. So, yeah, it's interesting that he made a choice to do that, not in a narrative fiction way.
Mm-hmm.
But was just like, no, I'm just going to write an essay instead.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes it's easy. If that's not the thing you want your book to be entirely about, but you do want the context to be there, it's a smart way to handle it. But yeah, not just people who want to make out American history to be like this heroic manifest destiny sort of God-given thing, but also a group of people who additionally will get super mad at you if you try to contextualize any of it.
You know?
Ever. Yeah.
Hmm. Hmm.
How will we learn about history without all these statues around all the time? This is how I mainly learn about history. If there's somebody who did something important and there's not a statue of them, I just don't know. I just don't know what their deal is.
Which is unfortunate, because there's so many statues of really terrible people. And you're just going to bump into them.
I know.
And that's all you're going
to
get.
This is me going to the wax museum and just trying to, like, who's this guy? I don't know. Let's find out.
I don't think I've ever, I think I've maybe gone to one wax museum.
Mm.
They're all so creepy.
Yeah, I don't, it's not great. It's where the Uncanny Valley was invented, in a wax museum.
Very slippery wax. So what is the transition from the essay to the book proper?
Well, so I'm not ready to go there yet. I did just want to talk about the essay thing that
Oh, sure.
sort of sets up more directly what the
Oh, I didn't know. Okay.
The theme of the book is he talks about a couple times about there's one essay that's just called Urbanity. There's another one called Hard Fast that talks about cities. Getting us to cities was supposed to be the final necessary step in our assimilation, absorption, erasure, the completion of a 500-year-old genocidal campaign. But the city made us new, and we made it ours. We didn't get lost amid the sprawl of tall buildings, the stream of anonymous masses, the ceaseless din of traffic. We found one another, started up Indian centers, brought out our families and powwows, our dances, our songs, our beadwork. We bought and rented homes, slept on the streets, under freeways. We went to school, joined the armed forces, populated Indian bars in the Fruitvale in Oakland and the Mission in San Francisco. We lived in boxcar villages in Richmond. We made art and we made babies and we made way for our people to go back and forth between reservation and city. We did not move to cities to die. The sidewalks and streets, the concrete absorbed our heaviness, the glass, metal, rubber, and wires, the speed, the hurtling masses, the city took us in. We were not urban Indians then. This was part of the Indian Relocation Act, which was part of the Indian Termination Policy, which was and is exactly what it sounds like. Make them look and act like us, become us, and so disappear. But it wasn't just like that. So yeah, again, like the thing about this book that I found the most interesting, that I had like encountered the least, is this depiction of native life that is not, not centered on a reservation, on finding community in a place where you're more mixed in with a bunch of different people and cultures and experiences. We talked about cities when we talked about the Toni Morrison book that you did too, right?
Oh yeah, like Jazz. Recently.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Jazz by Toni Morrison, of course.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I was thinking about that when I read some of the quotes from Orange about Native folks moving to cities in the mid 20th century, which is, 30, 40 years after the Great Migration of folks, Black folks leaving the South. Yeah, I imagine it's a different scale. It's different cities, I'm sure. But you're right to draw a comparison, I think.
Talking about the same, I think, effect of, even though they're, you move all these people into one place and sometimes it actually makes it a little bit easier to find a community just because of sheer density.
What Jazz was. I was struck by that in Jazz as well. It was there were characters who were giving voice to this sense of like,
Are you talking about Jazz the music or Jazz the book by Toni Morrison?
I was talking about the transformer named Jazz.
Oh, okay.
Who did move into the city at one point. He did. Mm-hmm. He lived on Cybertron first, and then he moved to New York City. Go ahead.
No, so you're talking about Jazz by Toni Morrison.
Oh, just that there were multiple characters, Jazz the Transformer included, who talked about moving to New York City and the fact that there were houses to rent. There was you could have a street that was all folks that you could connect with, you weren't spread out. You weren't in an innately hostile territory. That seems like a salient comparison. Good reference. A better reference than Jazz the Transformer.
The book itself, like this prologue essay part does not last very long. It's just kind of some table setting. And then the main book is split up into, there's also an interlude that has a little bit more essay stuff. We're probably not going to talk about that part. But the like main narrative is split up into like four loosely associated parts. Part one, two, three, four. Part one is called Remain. Part two is called Reclaim. Part three is called Return. And part four is called Powwow. So each little chapter within each part is talking about a different character. You're going to meet a lot of different characters. Usually, more often than not, a new chapter is going to introduce a new character, or it's going to be somebody you've met or heard about before in one of the other chapters, but it's somebody whose like perspective you have not inhabited yet.
Yeah, there was one or two references to this being like a little sort of an epic in like the scale of how many people were in there, but I know it's not a big book. Like how was your experience of the character roster?
Eventually you start you in part two especially, you start seeing, okay, I have not revisited any of the characters from part one yet, but I am getting perspectives of people who appeared in some of the stories in part one.
Okay.
And so in part one, I'm like, okay, is this just going to be like, there is a, the second character who you meet is a guy named Dean. Mm-hmm. I think that's D E N E is how I would pronounce.
Okay.
Dean. But he is, quote, not recognizably native. He's ambiguously non-white. Over the years, he'd been assumed Mexican plenty, been asked if he was Chinese, Korean, Japanese, Salvadoran once. But mostly the question came like this: what are you? So he is a youngish man who is trying to get grant money so he can do kind of a film project where he's like, his pitch is basically just, I'm going to find as many Native people from around Oakland as I can, and I'm just going to point a camera at them and like ask them to tell me a story.
Yes.
And this is the thing that sounds like it maybe is reflecting Tommy Orange's experience a little bit, where he is saying, you know, I'm going to let the content dictate what the end product ends up being. Mm-hmm. And then right after that, constantly telling himself that, and I, that does not mean that I'm just making it up as I go, probably. But yeah, just kind of trusting that in trying to do this thing of cultural worth, that eventually once you add it all up, it'll become clear what the through line is, and it'll become a compelling thing. And so it kind of sets you up to wonder, okay, is this book basically going to be this project, or is it going to like mirror this project in some way? And it kind of does.
Okay,
like it does set you up to be ready for what the rest of the book is doing. But this is all just to say, for a while I was not sure whether I was just going to be meeting new characters constantly all the time, or if we were working toward one like big event at the end. It does become clear that you are working toward one big event at the
end. It doesn't sound like is that he, and I think there are other books that do this instead, which is like, he could have written just his experience. Like he it sounds like he made a deliberate choice to not just like riff on his lived experience through.
But certainly it seems like fragments of it are in here, at least. Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. But from interviews and from what you're describing, it sounds like he approached this with a goal of representing a lot of different perspectives. Mm-hmm. Where other authors, you know, and this is not a judgment either way, would choose to be like, well, let me tell my story and hope that the specificity of it resonates with other people. And he is instead, because this is, I guess, one of the somebody, what did somebody say in a review? They said, this was from NPR. The risk with this kind of chorus line plot structure is that it can feel mechanical. The novel sometimes does when it stalls in the company of the weaker characters. So it's like, by being so cast of characters driven, if not all the characters hit.
Yeah, it's most of the characters do, thankfully. I think the characters who are the weakest are the ones who set up like the big tragic
thing at the
end. Like they are the least distinctly drawn to me. There's a lot of stuff about them kind of in the middle chapters that I lost track of. It does help that a lot of the other characters are like related in some way. Like it's kind of a loose family. Like if you're talking about, okay, what did the titles of the parts mean?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It is sort of a family that's been scattered apart by like choice and circumstance coming back together to be reunited by an event that's both like tragic, but also with the like possibility of something like good and hopeful coming out of it.
Cool.
Yeah. So that's interesting. I just want to talk about the, like, I don't think every character has like a super distinct voice always.
Okay.
I think that Tommy Orange's voice and the way that he writes is interesting.
Sure. I wanted to know more about that. Yeah.
So to talk about the title of the book for a sec, and listen, I'm not trying to attack you personally by reading this passage that Uh-oh. Depicts a white man that Dean runs into when he gets there to apply for his grant. There's a guy standing outside the door to the room he was told to go to. Dean hates who he thinks the guy is, who he has to be. He's the kind of bald that requires a daily shave. He wants it to look like he's in control of his hair, like being bald is his personal choice, but the faintest hint of hair appears on the sides and not a trace of the crown. He's got a sizable but neat light brown beard, which is clearly compensation for the lack of hair up there, plus a trend now, white hipsters everywhere trying to come off as confident, all the while hiding their entire faces behind big bushy beards and thick black rimmed glasses. Dean wonders whether you have to be a person of color to get the grant. The guy's probably working with kids on a garbage art project. Dean pulls out his phone in an attempt to avoid conversation.
Listen, I've never met Tommy Orange. I don't know how he knows this about me. I think the only thing I would quibble with is that I don't actually think that any actual hipster would ever consider me a hipster. I think I'm too square to be a hipster.
I think you're too, yeah, you're too like normcore.
I'm too earnest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I don't shave my head daily.
I'm not, I actually like your look works very well for you. And
I appreciate
that. I'm very happy that you found it because I have not bothered to interrogate my look in like 20 years.
Your look is a good solid brand, though.
It's fine. Yeah.
Like, what's nice is that your look matches the mental image I have of you in my head, and it's a good mm-hmm. one.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's just kind of unfair that Tommy Orange knows me so well.
It's kind of unfair that he looked at a picture of you and was like, how can I take this guy down a peg?
And like working with the kids on a okay, when he says garbage art project, does he mean garbage in a pejorative way or in like we're making art from garbage, which I would do?
Garbage art hyphenated, which I take to mean making yeah. art from garbage. Perhaps
listen,
with like underprivileged kids or something as
listen,
your project.
I love this. I'm glad I'm in this novel. I feel honored. Okay. And seen and represented.
But so talking about this guy, and the book doesn't, I mean, it's not all like takedowns of extremely specific white people. He talks about like Dean further talking about his interaction with this guy who asks him if he's read about Gertrude Stein because he's talking about being from Oakland and talking about how, you know, there's no authenticity left in this neighborhood or whatever.
Sure. Yeah.
And this is the guy's name is Rob. There is no there, he says in a kind of whisper with this goofy open mouth smile Dean wants to punch. Dean wants to tell him he looked up the quote in its original context in her Everybody's Autobiography and found that she was talking about how the place where she'd grown up in Oakland had changed so much that so much development had happened there that the there of her childhood, the there was gone. There was no there anymore. Dean wants to tell him it's what happened to Native people. He wants to explain that they're not the same, that Dean is Native, born and raised in Oakland, from Oakland. Rob probably didn't look any further into the quote because he'd gotten what he wanted from it. He probably used the quote at dinner parties and made other people like him feel good about taking over neighborhoods they wouldn't have had the guts to drive through 10 years ago. The quote is important to Dean, this there. He hadn't read Gertrude Stein beyond the quote, but for Native people in this country all over the Americas, it's been developed over buried ancestral land, glass and concrete and wire and steel, unreturnable covered memory. There is no there. So, you know, just there's another part where it's like, yeah, there is also the name of a Radiohead song.
Yeah, well.
But this is where it's interacting with where I think the name mostly is coming from.
Yeah, that's great. And again, that gets to the thing we were saying earlier with the essays where it's just like there is irrefutable, irreconcilable, irreversible, just world change that happened yeah. to Native people. And what else can you do but just mm-hmm. like recognize it and then build a life anyway because you're yeah. here. You're here here.
The other big thematic thing that I think is underpinning a lot of the characters in this book is like alcohol and specifically like using it to check out a little bit.
Okay.
There's a character who says, it's not the alcohol. There's not some special relationship between Indians and alcohol. It's just what's cheap, available, legal. It's what we have to go to when it seems like we have nothing else left. There are a lot of people in this book who are struggling with like substance issues or who have in the past. There are people, like I had mentioned earlier, also just like the identity issues and how those things are kind of like
wrapped up
in each other. So you're meeting a lot of different characters. In part two, it becomes clear that you're going to circle the same few characters over and over again. If not always from the same perspective, he's also doing some different, he's changing from like first to third person, sometimes in different chapters about the same character, just like doing
about
a little
the
bit
same
of,
character. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Just doing a little bit of, flourishing.
Yeah, sure.
In a way that maybe is contributing to that criticism of the book as being mechanical sometimes, just like,
yeah, but I guess
I'm just switching. It worked for me. Like I enjoyed it, but I can see how somebody reading this would feel like maybe it was a little gimmicky or something. You know what
sure,
I mean?
Sure. Yeah. I'm sure from his perspective, he's like, it's energizing. Like, I'm not going to come back to the same like POV with exactly the way it was last time you found it. Like, that's an interesting impulse.
Yeah. So it's, you start to make links as the chapters go on and realize like, oh, this character who had a baby and gave it up, like that baby is this character. And then she also like the guy whose baby it is also had like another kid with somebody else. And like these two like half siblings are going to meet each other eventually. And like, dude, and nobody really is intentionally like nobody in his family is intentionally moving all back together to all meet in the same place at the same time. But it is kind of what is happening. And the book is building toward this, powwow in Oakland, where everybody's going to go. And then also some like bad guys are going to go there and try to steal the prize money from the powwow to pay off like drug debt.
Okay.
Which is the stealing the money subplot and all like the, they 3D print guns and sneak them in and it's all like, it's all fine, but it was it felt like a little bit an effort to introduce conflict into what kind of started as let's point the camera at a bunch of people and tell some stories.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And is the tone of it, is the tone of that particular plot line, is it like really serious? Does it have a Coen Brothers whimsy to it?
No.
It doesn't?
It generally feels dark. And once it's clear that that's where it's heading, it just all feels very...
You're just waiting for it to whether or
not
it's going to pay off.
Yeah, it's just like, what bad thing is going to happen? And it does end up being the case where like a bunch of characters who you have met end up dying or getting shot.
Sure.
And like the bit of hope that comes out at the end of the book is like a lot of these people who are in this big extended messy family, there are a couple of sisters who haven't spoken in lots of years. The one sister's kids are being, man, this is complicated. The one sister's grandkids are being raised by the other sister, and the two sisters don't know that they're both going to be at this powwow together independently. But then, one of the grandkids gets shot in this scrum. And they all end up like back together at the hospital. And there's like this moment of hope where it's strongly implied that everybody's going to be okay. And everybody's, there's going to be an after this for this family in the wake of this tragic experience. I do kind of wonder how the book would have gone down if it had just focused on like the family conflict and like the family reunification of it, instead of also making it like a, it's my experience in the bad intro fiction writing seminar that I took in college, partly because I wrote one of these stories and partly because I read one of a bunch of them, is like, I always get immediately skeptical when I get to the part of a book that's like, and then there was a gun.
Yeah, you know, no, you've talked about that before. Yeah. I know that this really stuck with you because it does. Well, it's reminding me of when I read Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, because that book also has like an office shooter sequence in it, and it both feels of a piece with what the novel is about and also feels like a real big escalation relative to a lot of the character work that's going on in it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that there's any way to square that circle, because like for some books that's going to land fine and some books that might take you out. And I don't know that there's any way to predict it, because it could just be like how you're feeling on the day. But you're also hearing, you're also getting it in the like, and I can see what this is doing for the book structurally.
Mm-hmm.
Is it distracting you from the character stuff?
No,
that's working.
No, it's because it is so up and right up until the moment that the shooting thing is happening. It's mostly being doled out to you in little like bits and pieces of foreshadowing. Like the book stays. And what works the best about it is it does stay focused on its characters for pretty much the entire length until you get like right to the end and the shooting subplot kind of takes over.
Sure.
But just the way the different characters are like relating to their culture and the way like, so some of the characters who stick with me, there is Edwin, who is a like a recent college graduate who you know, graduating from college was kind of the peak of his life. And then he had like moved back in with his mom, and he's like mildly internet addicted in a way that is kind of a little, it manages to depict what it's like to just be like glued to your computer, like driven to distraction by like, oh, a thought popped into my head. I'm going to look up something about it, and then I'm going to fall down a Wikipedia hole for like 3 hours. It's very like true to having
true to life,
ADHD.
Yeah.
While also dealing with like the ways in which this guy does and does not feel native, and also like he has gained a lot of weight while he's been living at home, and just the way that he's like relating to his body now, and that like how complicated that was. I thought it was interestingly handled. There is Jackie Redfeather, who is one of the two sisters I mentioned. She had one baby that she gave up. She had another baby who died later, partly because of drug and alcohol abuse issues. And then she, Jackie herself, is an alcoholic who is on and off like recovering.
Okay.
But she has, partly because of the pain of losing her daughter, and partly because she doesn't like trust herself, has like given up her three grandkids who are living with her sister. So I thought that her struggle with like trying not to drink and like coming up on the edge of it and then walking back from it, and just the way that she, the way that she interacted with that, and the way that she, like, it just felt like a very lived in perspective, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
That was really compelling, and that'll stay with me. One of the grandkids, who is living with the sister, like experiences his grandmother as they all call, who is actually the character who's actually their great aunt, their grandmother, just because they live with her, and that's how it is. It's not like a secret thing where they don't know that their mom died and their real grandmother is gone. It's just like, this is how this family is constructed. But she, Opal, the grandmother, doesn't really want to like teach them a lot about their culture, not because she doesn't want them to know about it, but because she believes for whatever reason that they need to come to it on their own, like when they're ready. And so you've got the oldest of these three grandkids whose name is Orville Redfeather.
Okay.
He has been like watching like YouTube videos of like powwows and dancing, and he's found like this headdress in his grandmother's closet, and he gets up and he puts it on, and he like dances in front of the mirror, just like trying to research and like teach himself stuff about this part of his life that he feels really disconnected from, but he also really wants to be part of this powwow. Like, I just thought that it's just that not a, in the media that I've seen that has depicted Native characters, there are just a lot of different like archetypes in this that I had not spent a lot of time with. And so, there are a lot of them that I will be thinking about for a while, I think.
And I think that is the upside of a novel that's structured like this, mm-hmm, is that mm-hmm. you get a wide range of characters to choose from to connect with in a way. And like, you're not necessarily like reading the book and then picking who you're going to connect with, but it is the sense that like by sheer law of moderate size numbers, like there are going to be a few that hit you. The quote from the New York Times review by Colm Tóibín said, "No one in the novel is fully sure how to look or act, how to live or be." And that is what you, the character you just described reminded me of that.
Yeah. And it's really, I think, you know, it's true to being a person, but then also Orange lays on this extra layer of, you know, the native experience and what, and specifically like this urban native experience that he is interested in exploring.
Can you speak any more to that in terms of like how it's depicted or what issues are discussed?
I mean, I think it's just that so much of it is just that all of these characters live in or are from Oakland. Like I'm not going to say that the city is a character in the book because
you're allowed to say
but
it, Andrew.
But I don't want to say it because I don't think that's quite what the deal is.
Okay, like, sure.
The city is an important commonality that all the characters have.
Are there not pages that are like, and then the buildings of Oakland all sighed as everyone woke up and dreamed about whether or not they would have a baseball team next year? You know, like,
no, nobody ever said that. Though there are a couple people who think really fondly of like a couple of, like there were like a World Series stretch in like the 70s or something where they won three in a row or something. Yeah, mm-hmm.
A lot of Moneyball fans in this book.
They don't really mention Moneyball. I don't think they talk about Billy Bean or anything. The Oakland Athletics do come up a couple of times.
All right,
you know, just
cool.
Just kind of building a sense of place. I think that that's the biggest thing about the aside from. Just like, here are all these people who share this city in common, but otherwise like aren't really in each other's lives initially. Like their lives are sort of pulled together around this powwow thing. And the powwow is like it is a thing that is happening for the first time.
Cool. I was wondering about
in
that.
The book.
Okay.
Like it's, yeah. So you got a couple of characters who are working on making it happen. It's like a as Orange talked about in the little like prologue essay that I wrote, it's, you know, it is people from this community coming together to like found a thing so that their community has a place to get together and do what they want, whatever they want to do, whether that's like quote unquote traditional stuff or just like all existing in a place together. It's part of the, like, you know, you're rebuilding this community in this intentional way. It's just interesting.
You said the book ends feeling hopeful rather than pessimistic, given that there's people with guns and it's violent and
it's mostly about the characters that we've met. Like, maybe the people in this family are gonna all meet and get together and realize that they're all kind of related to each other, and something new will be built from this bad thing.
Okay.
I am curious what is explored in the sequel book. I assume it's at least some of this stuff, because I think the book cover of the sequel looks like it's got like bullet holes in it. So I've got to imagine that.
Okay, so the sequel, Wandering Stars, according to PenguinRandomHouse.com, delivers a masterful follow-up. This is a quote. Delivers a masterful follow-up to his already classic first novel, extending his constellation of narratives into the past and future. Tommy Orange traces the legacies of the Sand Creek Massacre of 1864 and the Carlisle Indian Industrial School through three generations of a family in a story that is by turns shattering and wondrous. And I think that is, that Carlisle School might be in PA, I think. Ooh. In Carlisle, PA.
Pennsylvania, you say?
Which I've heard about that school for like a number of different vectors in terms of like, they had sports programs, but it's also part of the legacy of, I think that's probably whatever like podcast where I first heard about this school, because I certainly wasn't taught about it in school like I probably should have been. It's part of the legacy of, you know, schools that were set up to, you know, strip Native people from their own societies, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But become, you know, then just becomes a part of Native history.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I wonder, it does not sound like this book, aside from what he did in the earlier essays, is like actively engaging with other time periods other than whatever the, you know, characters might be carrying around in their heads, right?
No, and that actually dovetails with something from there's a little Q&A at the end of the book.
Sure.
Where he talks a little bit about this, and specifically he's talking about, you know, those, sometimes you read these books that have these Q&As and it's like, is this an author like interviewing themselves or
sure.
There are a couple.
Why are you so cool, Tommy?
Well, it's just like, there are a couple of questions where Tommy Orange is just like, I don't care to, do you have a favorite character from the book? Tommy Orange? No.
Like, that feels real.
That
feels like
there?
The publisher was like, we need to interview this guy. He's so smart. And he's like, I don't care.
If he doesn't have an answer, then why include it in the Q&A? I don't know. I guess we're talking about it, aren't we?
I love it so much.
Uh-huh.
He can't choose. They're all his favorite.
Your cultural reference, this is the unnamed interviewer. Who may or may not be Tommy Orange. Your cultural references span across time, geography, and class, from what might be considered elitist to pop culture and everything in between. Was this a conscientious choice? If so, why? Tommy Orange says, I wanted to write characters who are as contemporary as possible. So much of what is written about Native Americans is in historical or stereotypical terms. So I very much wanted to write modern Native characters who transcend and transgress what has been written by Natives and non-Natives who fail to represent Native people as living now as relevant.
So that,
he's bringing this up. He mentions at least two or three times, you know, the old ad with the Native American who is crying about the garbage alongside the highway. He brings that up like a number of times as like, oh great, we've got like the test pattern guy and the litter crying guy, and that's kind of where a lot of Native representation in pop culture has stuck for a long time.
If it's those two, and then it's Westerns, right? Yeah. Like that's it. Yeah.
But like you have one character who's like, yeah, that Johnny Depp movie.
Oh my God.
Is bad, but something about watching him fail makes me happy. It's like basically what the character said.
I still can't believe he got to make that Lone Ranger movie. There's large parts of his career I wish just didn't exist, but I can't even believe that movie exists.
Everyone agreed on how bad it was in so many ways, but I was excited to see it. There's something about seeing Johnny Depp fail so badly that gives me strength. This again feels like it may be Tommy Orange peeking through one of his characters a little bit. The contemporariness and the lack of like,
yeah, for sure,
interacting with like a more historical time period is very much, very much intentional, and I think a lot of why the book feels fresh in the way that it does.
Like, well, and it explains,
it's not that Native people are in danger of being like overrepresented in media, but to the extent that we have representation, it does not explore the specific space as much, I don't think.
No, you're exactly right. And it explains to me why he like firewalled off the history perspective in a nonfiction voice at the front of the book. Like that, that makes that choice way clearer to me.
And then also did a follow up where he was more interested in dealing with the history. And he said it again in the Q&A with himself or whoever. He says, you know, I didn't plan this book as a series, or I didn't like write it with a follow up in mind. It's just I'd started like an idea for a follow up occurred to me, and it just was easy to write, and I started working on it, and here we are. Yeah.
Well, and he's also someone who sounds like he says he even came to just being a fan of literature like later in his life relative to other authors that he knows. So I'm not surprised that he just kind of like stumbled into, well, I mean, this is where my head's at. Like, let me stay here and follow this connection. I was reading about the test, the TV test art a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I went to what is this museum website I went to? Some like broadcast museum website in Rhode Island. The Museum of Broadcast Technology, and this artist who we don't know anything about, the name is just called Brooks. In this article, claims that everything about that test image is like meant to has like a very specific technical function.
Yeah, I'd read that about that test pattern too, where you're like, you know, you've got the way that the lines are arranged, and the fact that there are horizontal and vertical lines, and the numbers
dark hair
and
the white feathers are like meant to do contrast, and it's all sorts of interesting stuff. But then
it doesn't make it not like
it could have been anything
stereotypical depiction. Like, it doesn't make it not a weird decision, but it is interesting to read about the whys of like why the image is. If not why they chose like a stereotype of a native person, at least why like it needed to exist as an image in the first place.
Because it all goes away in the 60s once everybody's doing color programming and doing round-the-clock programming anyway. It was a thing where like at the end of the day, TV networks would be like, see you tomorrow.
Yeah, TV just went off.
It just went away. And engineers would throw up, you know, this image and then the various iterations of it to make sure that what they were broadcasting or, you know, on your television, like, looked the way it was supposed to look because all the technology was so new. So, like, the fact that there was a need for an image is interesting. The fact that it was this image in particular is interesting with a capital I.
It's interesting?
It's interesting.
With a question mark. Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, it sounds like you enjoyed the book, though.
I did. I feel like I'm probably doing the plot a little bit of a disservice, but I don't think that the plot is what it's for.
Yeah, like, sure.
I think that it's first and foremost about characters and then a little bit about structure.
Yeah, none of the reviews were like, this is a gripping yarn. This is a thriller, you know.
It's a real page turner, you know? And it is a page turner, but only insofar as like most of these characters are interesting, you know, and are hear more from them.
Yeah.
Or about them.
Yep. For sure.
But yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for telling me about There.
Thanks.
I don't know how to say the name of the book.
I mean, I guess if the phrase is there is no there, then the way we're supposed to say it is there.
Not there.
Not there, like in a consoling way.
Yeah.
But
okay.
There.
There. Woof. Glad we got to that by the end of the episode.
Yeah, anyway. Glad we got here.
Send us an email, overduepod@gmail.com. We'll be glad to read it. Find us online at overduepod.
Oh, we're online now, you say?
Yeah, social media. That's where most people are online. We're mostly on Instagram and Blue Sky. Find us there at Overdue Pod. Our theme song is composed by Nick Larangis. Got to say that. Andrew, if folks want to know more about the show, where do they go?
OverduePodcast.com is our internet website. We have our schedule. Getting to the end of March already, aren't we?
Yeah, we are.
Wild. Wild how time go. We also have a link up there to our Patreon project. That's patreon.com/overduepod. You can support the show financially, put our kids in school, get bonus episodes early, get access to our Discord community, and some other fun stuff. You get to sit on some bonus episodes early. You get to hear our long read episodes on Emily Wilson's translation of Homer's The Iliad. We just posted, did we just post them? Books we recorded the other day?
10 yeah, to 12? And so what? Okay, what's happening on the main feed? So by the time this episode is up, our February bonus episode will finally be on main feed. If you want to join us for those streams, got to go to Patreon.
Patreon.com/OverduePod.
At the end of this month, there will also be some of the Iliads. I don't remember which episodes. Maybe it's episodes 3 and 4 of our Iliad project.
The website says episodes 3 and 4.
Perfect. So you can hear those, but if you wanted to listen to them in order because you're reading along with us, you should go to patreon.com/OverduePod. That's how it works. Next week, Fight Club.
Ooh, I can't.
I'm
wait
not
to
supposed
have,
to talk about it.
I can't wait to, be two middle-aged white guys with opinions about Fight Club.
Listen,
I can't wait for that to manifest. That
it's been like 25 years since that movie came out. It's time to talk about it. No one's talked about
no
it.
No one's. Not enough people are talking about this movie.
Well, we're talking about the book.
Or the book. Maybe I'll watch the movie.
I have.
Maybe
no
I'll watch
idea
the movie
the
with the Chinese
like.
Ending.
I'm very. Oh, we will talk about it next week.
Yeah, we will. Even though we're not supposed to. They're going to kick us out of the club, but that's, you know what? It's worth it to bring you,
seems
the
like
listener,
a scary club.
This fresh and fun, funky, fresh commentary on the book Fight Club.
Yep.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening to our podcast for another week. Look at you. Good job. You're the real heroes. And until we fight you next week, please try to be happy.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.